injuring cell membranes, enzymes, and DNA itself. Such calamities are one variety of oxidative stress that our bodies must defend themselves against. They do so by relying on antioxidants, compounds that quench free radicals and neutralize destructive oxidation reactions. I'll have more to say about antioxidants when I discuss micronutrients. Even though they abound in fresh fruits and vegetables, there may be reason to add them to the diet in supplemental form for extra protection. When you deep fry foods, the fat you use reaches very high temperatures. It would be a good idea not to reuse that fat. At least it would be a good idea from the perspective of health. Economically, it might not make sense because fats and oils are costly. If you were a manufacturer of potato chips, the manager of an institutional cafeteria, or the owner of a restaurant, you could not afford to change the fat in your deep fryers after every use, or even very frequently. You would reuse it and continue to reuse it until it imparted a bad taste to foods. That is, until oxidized fat reached levels at which its taste and smell could not be ignored. A recent research paper in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology makes the possible consequences of this situation all too clear. Australian investigators fed volunteer subjects three different meals containing measured portions of fat. The first meal had 64.4 grams of used fat taken from the deep fryer of a fast food restaurant. The second meal had the same amount of unused cooking fat, and the third was a low-fat meal, 18.4 grams of fat. 4 hours after a meal, the researchers used a non-invasive test to measure blood flow through the brachial artery, the main artery supplying the arm. They found significant restriction of blood flow in subjects following the first meal, but not after the other two meals. Their interpretation of the finding was immediate dysfunction of the lining of the artery caused by oxidative stress resulting from entry into the blood of toxic compounds in the used fat. Think about that the next time you are tempted to eat fast food or order anything deep-fried in a restaurant. If the propensity of polyunsaturated vegetable oils to oxidize into compounds that damage the cardiovascular system and promote cancer is not enough to convince you to limit your intake of them, let me tell you of a final and possibly even greater danger they pose to health. I have said that a double bond in a fatty acid molecule strains it, forcing it to assume a shape other than a straight chain. Let's look at oleic acid, the most common monounsaturated fatty acid, and the principal fatty acid in olive oil. It is a non-essential monounsaturated fatty acid. Two possibilities exist for the shape of oleic acid. Without going into unnecessary details, I will tell you that one shape is called the cis configuration and the other the trans configuration. Because it takes a bit more energy to make cis oleic acid than to make trans oleic acid, cis oleic acid has a tendency to assume the more stable trans form, but trans oleic acid is unlikely to switch into the cis form. Now, almost all natural fatty acids with double bonds, monounsaturated and polyunsaturated fatty acids, are cis fatty acids. And since you know that polyunsaturated fatty acids are important structural components of membranes and building blocks for very important hormones, you can also understand that the configuration of these molecules would determine how well they function in these roles. The body uses cis forms to build membranes and hormones. Given trans forms to work with, it might produce defective membranes and defective hormones. This is exactly the possibility that some medical experts say exists because of the way that food processors handle the vegetable oils that end up on our tables and in our bodies. Most vegetable oils you buy in the supermarket are extracted from hard seeds with heat, pressure, and chemical solvents. Such extraction methods supply more than enough opportunities to turn cis fatty acids into their trans counterparts. Trans fatty acids, or TFAs, are unnatural forms of unsaturated fatty acids that some experts call funny fats. It is not funny that commercially processed oils are full of them. TFAs also form when oils suffer undue exposure to heat and light after extraction, and they are created in abundance when oils are subjected to a most unnatural process called partial hydrogenation. Read the labels of almost any brands of cookies, crackers, other baked goods or snack foods you pick up in the supermarket, and you will find partially hydrogenated oil high on the list of ingredients. Often the particular oil or oils are specified: partially hydrogenated soybean oil, or partially hydrogenated cottonseed, soybean, and/or corn oil. These are still other examples of foodstuffs that humans never ate before the 20th century, and I consider them chief suspects in undermining our health. It is clear that trans fatty acids are bad for hearts and arteries. They drive cholesterol production up like saturated fatty acids and promote atherosclerosis, undoing any benefits the oils might have provided. I am certain that trans fatty acids will eventually be found to be detrimental to health in many other ways as a result of their effects on membrane and hormone function. I believe they promote the development of cancer and degenerative disease, increase inflammation, accelerate aging, and obstruct immunity and healing. Therefore, I make a scrupulous attempt to keep them out of my diet, and I urge you to do the same. In practice, that means avoiding margarine, vegetable shortening, and all products made with them or with partially hydrogenated oils of any kind. When you start reading labels to look for those sources of trans fatty acids, you will be amazed and discouraged to see how prevalent they are in commercial foods. This recently got easier. In November 1999, the Food and Drug Administration began requiring that food labels list content of trans fatty acids. So this is what we've established with regard to fat. Too much saturated fat in the diet drives bad cholesterol up. Therefore, unless you are confident of your Methuselah lineage, you should not eat much animal fat, especially butter fat, as in cheese and other whole milk products, which is the main source of saturated fatty acids in the Western diet. You should also minimize consumption of the two tropical oils, palm and coconut, which also contain high proportions of saturated fatty acids. Of the two, coconut is the worse. If you like Thai or other curries made with coconut milk, try preparing them at home substituting cashew milk, which is primarily monounsaturated fat. Margarine is out, as are all foods containing partially hydrogenated oils. What we should be eating instead are the monounsaturated oils and fats and oils rich in omega-3 essential fatty acids, and these should be the main fats in the optimum diet. Monounsaturated fat lowers LDL cholesterol without disturbing HDL, resists oxidation much more than polyunsaturated oils, and is used by the body as a source of caloric energy almost as efficiently as saturated fat. These good fats have various sources. Many nuts contain primarily monounsaturated oils, among them cashews, pistachios, and macadamias. Walnuts are especially valuable as a source of omega-3 fatty acids in the form of linolenic acid. Shunned by advocates of Spartan low-fat regimens, nuts turn out to be healthy additions to the diet, much to my delight since I have always enjoyed eating them. Recent studies suggest that eating a portion, say a small handful of nuts a day, can lower LDL cholesterol and reduce serum triglycerides. Nuts are also a good source of fiber, minerals, and vitamin E. I recommend buying raw, natural, unsalted nuts and keeping them in the refrigerator until needed to protect them from going rancid. Once nuts are roasted or chopped, the oils in them will oxidize quickly. If you like cooked nuts, you can dry roast them yourself in the oven or toss them about in a hot skillet. Do not store them for long after heating them. Nut oils are flavorful, but because they have a high polyunsaturated fatty acid content, they are very susceptible to oxidation and should never be heated. Use walnut oil or hazelnut oil sparingly in salad dressings and keep them away from light and heat. Nut butters are also great in moderation. Look for almond, cashew, and macadamia nut butters as healthy alternatives to peanut butter, which has a higher percentage of saturated fat and is likely to contain traces of aflatoxin, a potent natural carcinogen produced by a mold that commonly grows on peanuts. In addition, many commercial brands of peanut butter contain partially hydrogenated oils. Read labels. Pumpkin seeds are an omega-3 source and make a pleasant snack. I buy raw organic ones, keep them refrigerated, and eat them frequently. If you like them toasted, cook small quantities in a dry skillet and use them up quickly. It is possible to find dark green pumpkin seed oil in natural food stores. Take the usual precautions with it and use it only in cold dishes. Avocados, another no-no on low-fat diets, are full of monounsaturated fat. You can make a butter alternative by mashing a ripe avocado and seasoning it to taste. Try it as a spread on bread to replace some of the saturated fat in your diet with a healthier form. You can find avocado oil in natural food stores, but it is bland and expensive and adds nothing special to dishes made with it. By contrast, olive oil is highly flavored and adds a great deal to food. It has the highest percentage of monounsaturated fat of any of the edible oils, 77%, and high-quality brands are now available in ordinary supermarkets. Because ripe olives are soft fruits rather than hard seeds, their fat can be extracted without using the harsh methods necessary to produce most vegetable oils. The best olive oil, labeled extra virgin, comes from the first gentle pressing of the fruits. Professional chefs often tell us to save it for special uses, like dipping bread in it at the table or dressing salads, and to use lower quality forms for cooking. I disagree. All the oil you eat should be the highest quality obtainable to minimize consumption of oxidized fat and trans fatty acids. Delicious, organic, extra virgin olive oil from California and Italy is now easy to find. Experiment with different brands to become familiar with the range of flavors of this useful oil. The main disadvantage of olive oil is that it provides almost none of the essential fatty acids, no linolenic acid and hardly any linoleic acid. But that just means that if you make olive oil your principal dietary fat, as I recommend that you do, you must make sure you are taking an adequate amount of omega-3s from other sources. Some people find the flavor of olive oil too strong or inappropriate for certain dishes, such as Asian stir-fries and cookies. One possibility is to use light olive oil for these recipes. It has a light color and neutral flavor, but the refining process that has removed color and flavor probably also reduces its health benefits. Another possibility is to use canola oil, the modern version of rapeseed oil, a traditional cooking fat of India and southern China. Rape is in the mustard family, and its seed contains some omega-3s in the form of linolenic acid, along with a substantial amount of monounsaturated fat, 62% of the total. Unfortunately, canola oil also contains up to 5% of erucic acid, a toxic fatty acid, which to my mind cancels out its potential value as an omega-3 source. The omega-3 fraction may even be removed from much commercial canola oil because it decreases shelf life of the product. Canola oil is neutral flavored, widely available, and heavily promoted as a healthy monounsaturated fat, but I consider it a distant runner-up to olive oil and use it rarely. Commercial canola oil is extracted in ways that damage the oil, and pesticides are used heavily on rape. If you do use canola oil, buy organic expeller-pressed brands available in health food stores or natural food sections of supermarkets. The only other vegetable oil with predominantly monounsaturated fat, 49%, is peanut oil, which also has a neutral taste. It contains some omega-6 fatty acids, but no omega-3s, along with more saturated fatty acids than canola oil and more polyunsaturated fatty acids than olive oil. I don't recommend it because methods of extraction damage its unsaturated fatty acid content. Besides, like peanut butter, it may contain traces of aflatoxin. Two special oils that are becoming more available are flax oil and hemp oil, both excellent sources of omega-3s. Flax seeds are the richest vegetable source of linolenic acid, but the oil expressed from them is so high in polyunsaturated fatty acids, 72%, that it is very susceptible to damage. Freshly pressed flax oil is sweet and nutty. However, by the time it gets to your table, it is likely to have an unmistakable undertone of oil paint. Look for flax oil in small opaque bottles in refrigerated cases or freezers of natural food stores. Don't use any that tastes like linseed oil. Keep it refrigerated, never heat it, and use it up quickly once you open the bottle. You can use flax oil in salad dressing or add it to other cold dishes. Hemp is the plant that produces marijuana, but it is at least as well known throughout the world as a source of high-quality fiber and edible seeds and oil. Hemp oil is greenish, also with a delicious nutty flavor, and is also an excellent source of essential fatty acids, although it provides less linolenic acid omega-3 and more linoleic acid omega-6 than flax oil. A major problem is that hemp is illegal. Even though the seeds and oil contain no intoxicating properties, their production for food is limited by restrictions on growers, and the quality of edible hemp products is therefore compromised. Nonetheless, I have started to see some good quality hemp oil in natural food stores. It is sold like flax oil and should be used in the same way. Nature protects these delicate oils from oxidation by enclosing them in tough seed coats. My preference is to eat the seeds to take advantage of their omega-3s rather than bothering with the extracted oils. Flax seeds are very cheap. You can buy them in bulk in natural food stores, and they keep well in storage, although I would still store them in the refrigerator. If you eat them whole, they will pass through you undigested. You must grind them to get their essential fatty acids. I suggest buying an electric coffee grinder that you dedicate to flax. Grind the seeds, say half a cup at a time, to a coarse meal and sprinkle it on food such as cereal, salad, baked potatoes, or other vegetables. You will find it has a pleasant, nutty taste. You can also buy ready-ground flax meal, but that defeats the purpose. Once ground, with greatly increased surface area, flax seeds are especially susceptible to oxidative damage. Be aware that flax seeds, as opposed to flax oil, contain a great deal of fiber that will increase stool bulk and even act as a laxative depending on how much you eat. 2 tablespoons of freshly ground flax seeds daily will add a good measure of omega-3 fatty acids to your diet. In the case of hemp seeds, I prefer to dry toast them and eat them as a snack. Put a layer of raw hemp seeds in a dry skillet and stir them over medium-high heat until they begin to pop and lightly brown. Add a tiny amount of olive oil to coat them, remove them from the heat, and season them to taste, for example with salt, soy sauce, garlic powder, or chili powder. Let them cool before eating them. They are quite delicious. Use them up quickly, which should not be a problem. I mentioned above that soy oil, a predominantly polyunsaturated oil, also provides essential fatty acids, as do mayonnaise and commercial salad dressings made with soy oil and canola oil. Egg yolks in mayonnaise may also contribute, although probably mostly omega-6s, unless the chickens were lucky enough to be free-ranging or received supplemental algae in their feed. If you use mayonnaise in bottled salad dressings, you would do well to look for natural brands containing those oils. I am a great proponent of eating soybeans and foods made from them for many reasons, one being the content of essential fatty acids in the oil. But I do not recommend soy oil for cooking because the extraction of it involves heat solvents, bleaches, and other treatments that damage its high content of polyunsaturated fatty acids. That brings us to the fish oils, perhaps the most valuable sources of omega-3s, certainly of the preformed very long-chain omega-3s, EPA and DHA, that appear to be critically important for optimum cardiovascular, neurological, and mental health. Let me repeat that our bodies can make these vital nutrients from dietary linolenic acid, but that the conversion is often inefficient, especially if the necessary enzymes are overwhelmed by excess omega-6 fatty acids in the diet. For that reason, I think it is useful to eat the oily cold water fish that provide them, such as salmon, sardines, mackerel, and herring. The fat of cold water marine mammals, such as seals and whales, is also full of them, and is surely the reason that traditional Inuit did not suffer from atherosclerosis and coronary heart disease, despite their consumption of huge amounts of total fat and saturated fat. Marine mammals are not in our diets, but fish certainly are. I will discuss them in more detail, pointing out their advantages and disadvantages, in the next section on protein. Here I will simply repeat that it is good to include fatty fish in the diet. I recommend 2 to 3 servings of them a week, more if possible. Generally, I do not recommend taking extracted fish oils in supplemental form. In the first place, if you are trying to keep total fat intake to moderate levels, it seems a shame to waste your fat calories on capsules. Second, fish oils, since they are so unsaturated, oxidize quickly. They are likely to be more intact in fish than in supplements. Third, a serious problem with fish is toxic contamination. I will say more about that in the next section too, which is why I am concerned about commercial fish oil supplements. I would need assurance that they are free of the toxins that are so prevalent in fish today. Now, having armed you with a great deal of information about dietary fats, the dangers of bad fats, and the benefits and sources of good fats, I would like to conclude this section by summarizing my views on these most important macronutrients and giving specific recommendations about using them. One outstanding danger of very low-fat diets, that is 10 to 20% of calories as fat, is essential fatty acid deficiency. The danger is greater on vegetarian low-fat diets, since they exclude fish and eggs and include seeds and oils that worsen an already distorted omega-6 to omega-3 ratio. Unless great care is taken to get enough omega-3 fatty acids on these diets, all the health risks associated with deficiency of them will rise. The second danger of very low-fat diets is increased cardiovascular risk due to excess consumption of carbohydrates and attendant changes in the serum lipid profile. In general, fat and carbohydrates substitute for each other in the diet. Lower one and the other increases. Some people eating 10% of calories as fat eat 70 or even 80% of calories as carbohydrate, way too much, and develop high levels of serum triglycerides. In addition, men on these diets show decreased amounts of HDL, along with LDL particles which become smaller and denser, a form that may be linked to a high risk of atherosclerosis. These risks may be overshadowed by a large decrease in overall LDL, which may account in part for Dr. Ornish's ability to demonstrate reversal of coronary artery disease with his program of lifestyle modification that combines a very low-fat diet with moderate exercise and intensive group support. I have no hesitation about referring patients with existing cardiac disease to this program and others like it, especially patients facing unappealing allopathic interventions like coronary artery bypass graft surgery or angioplasty. They certainly have the motivation to undertake such a rigid diet, and these programs reduce the occurrence of so-called cardiac events, heart attacks and the like, in patients with diseased hearts. But I wonder if disease reversal takes place in spite of the diet, or whether a more palatable diet with the right kinds of fat, combined with the same sort of exercise and group support, would work even better. Palatability of food decreases sharply as fat calories drop below 20% of total calories. Maintaining a 10% fat diet is very difficult unless you live at a spa, hire a professional chef, or are willing to give up the pleasure of eating. Most people can enjoy optimum health on a diet containing 30% fat. The example of Crete and other Mediterranean regions suggests that even more fat in the diet might be acceptable as long as it is made up of predominantly monounsaturated and essential fatty acids with a favorable omega-6 to omega-3 ratio. Reduce the amount of saturated fat in the diet by cutting back on butter, cream, whole milk, yogurt, and especially cheese made from whole milk. If you like dairy products, try to use low-fat forms, such as low-fat or skim milk, and cheese made from part skim milk. Cut back on meat and unskinned poultry, or substitute wild game. Minimize consumption of palm and coconut oils. Conventional nutritionists recommend an equal distribution of the three kinds of fat, so that in a 30% fat diet, 10% of the calories would come from saturated fat, 10 from monounsaturated fat, and 10 from polyunsaturated fat. I recommend a ratio of 1 to 2 to 1, that is 5% of calories from saturated fat, 20 from monounsaturated fat, and 5 from polyunsaturated fat. If you are eating 2,000 calories a day, 30% of those calories, 600, can come from fat, and no more than 100 should be from saturated fat. The more saturated fat you eat, the more important it is to pay attention to essential fatty acid intake and the omega-6 to omega-3 ratio. Avoid polyunsaturated vegetable oils, that is safflower, sunflower, sesame, corn, soy, cottonseed, and products made from them. Strictly avoid margarine and vegetable shortening and products made from them. Strictly avoid all products containing partially hydrogenated oils of any kind. Use extra virgin olive oil as your main fat. If you do not want a strong flavor of olive oil in a particular dish, search out milder flavored brands or use a light olive oil. Organic expeller-pressed canola oil may be used in moderation as an alternative neutral-tasting oil. Buy all oils in smaller rather than larger sizes and use them up quickly once you open them. Protect all oils from light and heat. If you use olive oil frequently, keep a small amount out and refrigerate the rest. It will slowly congeal in the cold due to its 14% content of saturated fatty acids. Hardened olive oil is easily returned to the liquid state by placing the bottle which contains it in warm water. Flavorful nut oils, walnut, hazelnut, pistachio, may be used in moderation in cold foods. Roasted, dark sesame oil is another oil that is acceptable in the small quantities used to flavor Chinese and Japanese recipes. Its flavor is quite concentrated. A teaspoon or two is enough for most dishes. Pumpkin seed oil, flax oil, and hemp oil are all rich in essential fatty acids, including the vital omega-3s, and can be used. Make sure they smell and taste good before you use them, protect them from light and heat, and use them up quickly in dressings or other cold foods. I am more in favor of eating the seeds they come from, raw or freshly toasted pumpkin and hemp seeds, and freshly ground flax meal. Never heat any oil to the point of smoking, and never breathe the smoke of heated or burning fat. It is highly toxic. Do not eat deep-fried foods in restaurants, especially fast food restaurants. If you deep-fry foods at home, which you are better off not doing much of, throw the oil out after cooking rather than saving it for reuse. You can spend some of your fat calories on avocados, nuts, not peanuts, and nut butters, not peanut butter. Walnuts are particularly valuable nutritionally because they are an omega-3 source. Raw, natural nuts are best. If you like them roasted, cook them yourself and use them up quickly. Store nuts and nut butters in the refrigerator. If you eat eggs, use only eggs from free-range chickens or look for the new eggs fortified with omega-3 fatty acids. If you use mayonnaise or bottled salad dressings, buy natural brands made with olive, soy, or canola oils. Eat soybeans and foods made from them, soy milk, tofu, mock meats, for their omega-3 fatty acids. Eat fish that contain omega-3s regularly, at least 2 or 3 times a week. If you do not eat fish, concentrate on the vegetable sources of omega-3s, walnuts, flax seeds, hemp seeds, and make an effort to decrease consumption of omega-6 fatty acids by cutting way down on the common vegetable oils other than olive oil and products made from them. It is especially important for pregnant women in the last trimester and nursing mothers to get adequate amounts of omega-3s, preferably from fish. If you like chocolate, you will be glad to know that the body handles cocoa butter like olive oil. Cocoa butter does not raise cholesterol and has a beneficial effect on the serum lipid profile. Buy high-quality dark chocolate only. Milk chocolate contains butterfat, which moves cholesterol levels in the wrong direction, and cheaper products replace cocoa butter with undesirable fats like palm oil, which is highly saturated, or even with partially hydrogenated oils. Read labels. I hope I have not overwhelmed you with information about fat. It is information you need to help you navigate through a confusing world and be a savvy consumer. The kind of fat you eat has a major influence on your health and longevity, and misinformation on this subject is the rule rather than the exception. Note that, as is the case with carbohydrates, it is the processing of fat-containing foods that reduces their protective qualities and makes them unhealthy, yet another reason to include more natural, unprocessed foods in your diet. If you tell people you are a vegetarian, a usual response is, "Where are you getting your protein?" No one ever asks, "Where are you getting your fat?" or "Where are you getting your sugar?" It is only protein that people seem to worry about getting enough of. In the 1960s and 1970s, when large numbers of young Americans began experimenting with vegetarianism, conventional nutritionists warned them and their parents of the danger of protein deficiency. And one wrote in a syndicated newspaper column that it was impossible to maintain health on diets that excluded animal foods. A popular book of the time, Diet for a Small Planet by Francis Moore LaPay, unintentionally reinforced this concern by explaining that animal protein was complete, providing all of the 10 essential amino acids, whereas vegetable protein was incomplete, lacking one or more of them. The solution, the author suggested, was protein combining, eating grains and beans together, for example, so that the amino acid deficiencies of one food would be covered by another food at the same meal. She meant well and was actually arguing for vegetarian diets, pointing out that feeding grains to animals was incredibly wasteful when those grains could be put to more efficient use feeding people. Unfortunately, all the talk about incomplete protein left vegetarians feeling vulnerable. Unless they had calculators and tables of food composition at the ready, they could be on a fast track to malnutrition. In fact, protein needs are much lower than most people imagine, and the risk of protein deficiency for most of us is negligible. The early signs of protein deficiency are clear. Hair and nails stop growing and wounds do not heal. I often recommend low-protein diets to patients with allergies, as well as those with autoimmunity, liver, or kidney problems, and I have never seen these symptoms appear in any of them. Even athletes, persons doing heavy physical labor, and pregnant women are not at greater risk. Ordinary diets supply more than enough protein for them. Protein needs are increased in nursing mothers, actively growing children, and persons recovering from serious illness and injury. But even in those cases, ordinary diets are usually fine. Only people experimenting with strange, very restrictive diets, fruitarians, for example, or alcoholics or very poor people subsisting on starch are likely to become protein deficient in our societies. Having said that, I must also say at the start of this discussion that I think we know less about protein than we do about carbohydrate and fat, particularly about individual variations in needs for it and for specific amino acids. Some individuals who eliminate animal protein from their diet find themselves moping and drooping. They feel better instantly when they again eat meat. Others say that soy foods and grain burgers suit them just fine. Some people seem to do best eating protein as the main course of every meal. Others feel lethargic if they eat too much protein at even one meal. So finding the right amount of this macronutrient to include in the optimum diet is tricky. I recommend getting 50 to 60% of calories from carbohydrate, as much of that as possible from unrefined, low glycemic index carbohydrate foods, and 30% of calories from fat, mostly from monounsaturated oils and foods high in omega-3 fatty acids. That leaves 10 to 20% of calories from protein, which on a 2,000-calorie daily diet would be 200 to 400 calories, or about 50 to 100 grams. Advocates of low-fat, high-carbohydrate diets would say that 20% protein is too much, while those in favor of low-carbohydrate, high-protein diets would say it is not enough. I think 10 to 20% of calories as protein is the right general range. Recall that protein consumed in excess of the body's needs for growth becomes fuel that the body burns for energy, and that protein is a relatively inefficient and dirty fuel compared to carbohydrate and fat. Because protein molecules are so complex, the ratio of energy expended to energy gained in dismantling and metabolizing them is less favorable than that for running the metabolic engine on fat or carbohydrate. Because protein molecules contain nitrogen, when they are burned to yield energy, they leave nitrogenous residues instead of just producing water and carbon dioxide, the only waste products of the metabolism of fat and carbohydrate. As I said earlier, the end waste product of the metabolic combustion of protein is the simple compound ammonia. To protect itself from this very toxic substance, the body converts it to urea, a task that falls on the liver. Urea is much less toxic than ammonia, but still a waste product of metabolism that must be eliminated. It is up to the kidneys to remove it from the bloodstream and get it out of the system in urine. High-protein diets, therefore, in which much of the protein consumed winds up as fuel for energy production, have the following effects on the body. 1. An increased workload on the liver. 2. An increased workload on the kidneys. And 3. Possible exposure of sensitive organs to toxic metabolic wastes. Most people think that eating a lot of protein, animal protein especially, builds strong bodies and bones. That may not be the case. High-protein diets actually cause calcium loss from the body and from bones. Women in sub-Saharan Africa have very strong bones, even though they eat grain-based diets and get only a small fraction, about 250 milligrams a day, of the recommended intake of calcium, which is 1,500 milligrams a day. On the other hand, traditional Inuit, who eat huge amounts of animal protein along with their fat, have severe osteoporosis. Of course, genetics and vitamin D levels also differ in these populations. The body makes vitamin D, necessary for absorption and utilization of calcium, from cholesterol on exposure to sunlight, and Inuit get little sun in the winter. Nonetheless, I think very different levels of protein intake in these disparate populations strongly influence the condition of their bones. A further possibility is that high-protein diets may irritate the immune system, keeping it off balance and making it more likely to react against harmless substances in the environment, like pollen and animal dander, allergies, or to attack the body's own tissues, autoimmunity. Allergy and autoimmunity both have significant genetic roots, and both are also influenced by environmental triggers. For example, the protein in cow's milk, called casein, seems to be the responsible environmental trigger that sets off common forms of allergy in infants and young children, and possibly autoimmune reactions as well. The timing of first exposure to milk protein may be all important. If one or both parents has an allergic history, a child is at increased risk to develop allergy as well. Exposing the child to milk protein too early in life, before the age of 2, say, may activate the allergic potential, causing such reactions as eczema and asthma, and setting up the immune system for high allergic responsiveness for the rest of the child's life. If cow's milk is withheld until the critical period has passed, allergy may not develop. Research also suggests that during some critical window of early life, cow's milk protein may also trigger the autoimmune reaction that destroys insulin-producing cells of the pancreas, actualizing an inherited tendency toward the development of juvenile diabetes. In practice, I find that patients with problems of allergy and autoimmunity often improve on low-protein diets, especially on plant-based diets that restrict animal protein in general and milk protein in particular. Since the immune system focuses primarily on protein molecules in determining whether a substance belongs in the body or not, it makes sense that one could quiet a sensitive immune system by not flooding the system with more dietary protein than it needs for growth, maintenance, and repair of tissues. Let me repeat that there is much uncertainty here. We just do not know why some people do better eating more protein and others do better eating less, and research is definitely needed to document the health problems that may be associated with diets that supply a high percentage of calories as protein. There is also much confusion about the kinds of protein foods that should predominate in the diet for optimum health. At the risk of going beyond what we know scientifically at present, I would like to examine this question and give you my opinions, starting with a consideration of the relative advantages and disadvantages of animal versus non-animal sources of protein. Animal sources of protein include meat from cows, pigs, and sheep, and to a much lesser extent of wild game like deer, elk, and moose. The flesh of chicken and other poultry, eggs, mostly from chickens, milk, mainly from cows and products derived from it, fish and shellfish. Because we are much more closely related to animals than to plants, their proteins are more like ours, and it is easier for the human body to rearrange them into new molecules for its own needs. As energy sources, animal and plant proteins are equivalent. However, there are important differences between common animal and non-animal protein foods in terms of what other elements they supply or fail to supply. For example, meat, obtained mostly from the skeletal muscles of large herbivores, comes marbled with fat that is mostly saturated and makes a significant contribution to the total saturated fat intake of human carnivores. Most people prefer meat with a higher content of this internal fat because it is juicier and more tender. In fact, in the grading system for beef used by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the highest grade of prime goes to the meat with the most fat in it. Beef fat is the worst animal fat in terms of chemical composition, containing 51% saturated fatty acids, 44% monounsaturated fatty acids, and only a trace of polyunsaturated fatty acids. By contrast, the fat of pigs, lard, has 41% saturated fatty acids, 47% monounsaturated fatty acids, and 12% polyunsaturated fatty acids. Americans' love of beef not only helps push daily protein intake far above basic protein needs, but also skews dietary fat in an unhealthy direction. Remember also that although the polyunsaturated fatty acid content of fat of all domestic animals, pigs and sheep as well as cows, includes some linoleic acid, it has no omega-3s as a result of the practice of fattening these animals on grains. Thus, eating a lot of meat contributes to the present undesirable ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acids in the modern diet. Doctors often warn patients away from organ meats, liver, kidneys, sweetbreads, and the like, because they are high in cholesterol. But as I have pointed out, cholesterol that you eat has far less impact on cholesterol in your blood than the saturated fat you eat. I am more concerned about possible concentrations of heavy metals, environmental toxins, and infectious agents in organ meats, which is the main reason I recommend avoiding them, even though they are sources of B vitamins and some trace minerals. The possibility of infection from animal organs, though small at the moment, came spectacularly to public attention with the outbreak of bovine spongiform encephalopathy, mad cow disease, in England in the late 1980s. Human cases of this fatal brain disease that resulted from eating the meat of infected cows are well documented. Whether the meat included brain tissue or not is unclear. Sloppy procedures in slaughterhouses can contaminate muscle tissue with bits of brain. This disease and variants of it that occur spontaneously in humans and many animals can be transmitted from one species to another by eating infected tissue. In England, the disease became widespread in beef cattle as a result of the unnatural practice of feeding them parts of carcasses of sheep infected with scrapie, the ovine form of spongiform encephalopathy. The agents responsible for these diseases are prions, a newly recognized class of pathogens that carry information but are non-living. Prions are simply very small proteins that can disrupt cellular information systems and are remarkably resistant to most of the methods of disinfection used to destroy more complex and familiar disease agents like viruses, bacteria, and parasites. They cause slowly developing incurable brain degeneration that is always fatal, and their discovery has made scientists suddenly aware of hazards of animal products never before considered. After studying prions and the diseases they cause, I have stopped using bone meal and blood meal in my garden. If animals that yielded the meal were infected, inhaling dust from these products could put prions in your system. I now recommend synthetic rather than animal-derived hormones to patients with endocrine deficiencies, and I am more comfortable than ever with my own lacto-pesco vegetarian diet, that is, milk products and fish in addition to plants. I do not cite the spongiform encephalopathies to scare you away from eating meat, but I do urge you never to eat brains. I also recommend not eating other organ meats frequently or in quantity, as the risk is much higher than with muscle. Sloppiness in slaughterhouses can also contaminate meat with fecal matter and dangerous bacteria, especially the deadly forms of E. coli that have caused much publicized illness among meat eaters in both the United States and Japan. Separate from the possibility of serious infections carried in meat is the issue of toxic contamination of foods of animal origin, having to do both with our methods of raising animals and with environmental contamination in general. Commercially raised animals are fed estrogenic hormones to make them gain weight faster and antibiotics to increase growth rates. Residues of these drugs in meat can impact human health adversely. The hormones add to total estrogenic pressure on women from many sources, increasing risk of breast cancer, other cancers of the female reproductive system, and other estrogenically driven conditions, fibrocystic changes in breasts and uterine fibroid tumors, for example. The hormones may also promote the development of prostate cancer in men. Antibiotics in meat certainly contribute to the escalating problem of antibiotic-resistant bacteria, which are becoming prevalent in the world. Furthermore, large animals, even herbivorous ones, live at the tops of food chains, the sequences of organisms in which larger ones feed on smaller ones and are, in turn, eaten by still larger ones. At each higher level of a food chain, environmental toxins are more concentrated. From this point of view, diets lower in animal foods are definitely healthier because they deliver lower doses of environmental toxins, a broad range of pollutants that can cause cancer and damage to many systems of the body, including the immune system and nervous system. Poultry differs from the meat of large grazing animals in several important respects. For one thing, its fat is external to muscle instead of being distributed through it, so that it can be removed before cooking, a great advantage if you are trying to reduce consumption of saturated fat. Chicken fat has a healthier composition than the fat of cows, pigs, and sheep, only 30% saturated fatty acids. Essential fatty acids are present, but again, only omega-6s in the grain-fed caged birds that dominate the market. Antibiotics and hormones are used in abundance in raising chickens for food, and a risk of infection exists as well, especially from salmonella bacteria as a result of unsanitary methods of slaughter and butchering. Here, too, healthier versions are available with some difficulty and at higher prices. Specialty stores sell organically raised, drug and hormone-free chicken from birds that got to run around on the ground and scratch for food. If I ate chicken, it would be the only kind I would buy. All of these considerations apply to other birds raised for food, turkeys, ducks, and geese. In recent years, lean turkey meat has appeared as a substitute for beef and pork in sausages, burgers, and other processed meats, healthier options because of their much lower content of saturated fat. Ducks and geese are fattier than chicken. If you eat them, you should take care to remove as much of their fat as possible before cooking. I have already discussed eggs of chickens as a good source of omega-3 fatty acids if they come from free-range chickens or chickens whose diets are supplemented with omega-3-rich algae. It is the yolk of the egg that contains the fat and the cholesterol. Egg white is pure protein of a sort that the body can easily assimilate and use. If you like eggs and take care to cook them in healthy ways, you can include whole eggs from drug and hormone-free, uncaged chickens in the optimum diet in moderation, say an average of one egg a day. The implications of relying on dairy products as protein sources are more complicated. As I noted above, the protein in milk is suspect as an allergen and irritant of the immune system in people with allergic family histories. In addition, milk provides the other two macronutrients in forms that can be problematic. Lactose, the sugar in milk, is the only carbohydrate of animal origin in our diets. Its digestion requires the enzyme lactase that many adults lack, causing them to suffer digestive distress if they drink milk or eat milk products containing lactose. People of Northern European origin make lactase throughout life, but others, especially Asians and Africans, no longer produce it once they are weaned in infancy. For this reason, some nutritional experts strongly object to the dairy industry's intense promotion of milk as a necessary element of the healthy diet to meet calcium as well as protein needs. These critics consider the propaganda ethnocentric, if not racist, and advise that lactose-intolerant individuals and cultures look elsewhere for protein and calcium. Moreover, butterfat, the fat in whole milk that becomes highly concentrated in cream, ice cream, cheese, and of course butter, is the most saturated of the animal fats, delivering a whopping 54% of saturated fatty acids. Butterfat in the Western diet, particularly in the form of cheese, is probably the greatest single contributor to the overload of saturated fat, responsible for the high rates of cardiovascular disease in our societies. Butterfat is also one of the only natural sources of trans fatty acids, formed as a result of bacterial transformation of unsaturated fatty acids in the stomachs of cows. I and most people I know love cheese, even though we eat it in moderation. We love it for its unctuous texture and complex range of flavors that include notes of earth, mushrooms, and in riper varieties, distinctly animal tones that in other contexts might be disagreeable. And the combination of sweet, fat, and cold in ice cream is almost irresistible. I include some dairy products in my diet. I like cheese and note that it is part of the Mediterranean diet, which I consider a strong example of a healthy diet. I do not drink milk or use cream, rarely eat ice cream, and have come to replace almost all the butter I used to eat with olive oil. I will give you specific suggestions for using dairy products wisely at the end of this section, but I do want you to be aware of the reasons for not making them your main source of protein. Aside from the hazards of its natural constituents, milk today may adversely affect health for other reasons. Unpasteurized milk can transmit serious infectious diseases such as tuberculosis and brucellosis. Homogenization of milk, designed to prevent the cream from separating, changes the size of butterfat particles in ways that may make them more likely to contribute to atherosclerosis. Environmental toxins can accumulate in milk, especially in its fatty fraction. And drugs and hormones given to dairy cows to increase milk production will also find their way into nature's most perfect food. This last danger has become a focal point of contention because of the recent advent of recombinant bovine somatotropin, or BST, also known as bovine growth hormone, BGH, a synthetic hormone used to make dairy cows produce significantly more milk. The manufacturer of this product has promoted it heavily and spent a fortune to convince government agencies and consumers that BST presents no hazards to cows or people, only great economic benefits to dairy farmers. Consumers remain suspicious, as do I. The problem is that use of BGH can increase rates of mastitis, inflammation of udders, requiring greater use of antibiotics. Residues of antibiotics in milk contribute significantly to the development of antibiotic-resistant bacteria in people. The milk of goats and sheep is mainly used to make cheese, but goat's milk is sometimes recommended as a substitute for cow's milk for children who are allergic or otherwise intolerant to casein. Goat's milk is somewhat closer to human milk in composition, but the milk fat of all these species is highly saturated and best consumed in moderation. I would now like to discuss the remaining animal sources of protein, fish and shellfish, and then look at the pros and cons of vegetable protein from beans, grains, and nuts. Earlier, I extolled the virtues of certain fish as sources of omega-3 fatty acids, particularly of the longer-chain members of that family, EPA and DHA, that the body may have difficulty synthesizing from the precursor linolenic acid that occurs in seeds and nuts. Epidemiological evidence consistently shows that populations eating fish have better health and longevity than those that don't, and suggests that the more fish people eat, the better. Of course, many commonly eaten species of fish, such as halibut, flounder, cod, and sole, are not fatty and do not provide omega-3s. Nonetheless, their inclusion in the diet seems to be healthy. Why? One possibility is that people who eat a lot of fish do not eat a lot of meat, and so take in less saturated fat. Another is that fish might contain other protective factors yet to be discovered. For much of history, fish has had the reputation of being the poor man's meat. Ironically, as tastes have changed in the developed world, as more people have learned about the health benefits of eating fish, and especially as populations of fish throughout the world have dwindled as a result of overharvesting, the price of fish has increased enormously, often making it more expensive than meat. Besides depleting fishing grounds once considered inexhaustible, like the Grand Banks off Newfoundland, human activity has harmed fish in another way, decreasing its value as a healthier source of animal protein. Pollution of the world's oceans, lakes, and rivers, with a great variety of industrial and agricultural wastes, has put toxins into the food chains of which fish are a part. For saltwater species, the larger the fish, the more carnivorous it is, and the more time it spends in coastal waters where contaminated effluents are greatest, the likelier it is to have dangerous amounts of environmental toxins in its flesh. For freshwater fish, contamination is so great a concern that I advise shunning it altogether, unless you know for sure that the water it came from was unpolluted or the fish is farm-raised. Fish farming has its own problems. It is becoming big business, especially for salmon, trout, sturgeon, catfish, and tilapia. Farmed fish live in unnaturally crowded pens and are susceptible to diseases as a result. Farmers routinely give them antibiotics. The diseases incubated in these populations can escape to infect wild populations, sharply decreasing their numbers. Furthermore, unless the feed given to farmed fish is thoughtfully designed, their nutritional value may be less than that of their wild counterparts. This is an issue particularly with salmon. Farmed salmon contain fewer omega-3 fatty acids than wild salmon, unless, just as is the case with chickens, they get supplements of algae rich in those vital nutrients. Given the booming market for farmed salmon, I keep waiting for some clever entrepreneur to bring to market an organically raised, drug-free product with an omega-3 content equal to or greater than that of wild salmon. The term shellfish applies to two very different kinds of animals, crustaceans and mollusks. Crustaceans include lobsters, crabs, shrimp, and crayfish. Their flesh contains cholesterol but little fat and provides high-quality protein. But their feeding habits pose certain risks to health. Crustaceans are scavengers and bottom feeders. They live in places where toxic pollutants accumulate. These creatures can be farmed, and if farmers take care to provide them with clean water, their value as protein foods is much higher. Mollusks, such as clams, oysters, mussels, and scallops, are distant from us biologically, although octopus and squid, which are also in this category, have quite complex nervous systems and behavior. The practice of eating raw shellfish is particularly risky because of possible viral and bacterial infection. Serious diseases like hepatitis and cholera can be acquired in this way, and other shellfish-borne infections that would not bother most of us can be life-threatening for those with compromised immune systems, patients on immunosuppressive drugs, and persons with AIDS. The possibility of toxic contamination here is also great. I like to spend time on islands in the Strait of Georgia between mainland British Columbia and Vancouver Island, an area famous for rich oyster beds that were a major protein source for the Native Americans who once dominated the region. Today, numerous paper mills discharge noxious effluents into the ocean, not only interfering with the reproduction of oysters but making them questionable as food. That completes a survey of the common animal sources of protein. Before I leave the subject, I should note some general pros and cons of these foods. Many of them provide vitamins and minerals that the body needs. Meat, for example, is an important source of iron that is superior to vegetable sources because it is more bioavailable. That is, the body can use it more efficiently than iron in plants or supplements. For many people, milk and milk products are good sources of calcium. As a group, these foods provide many of the vitamins in the B complex. They are, however, devoid of two categories of micronutrients I will discuss in the following section, fiber and phytochemicals. And one of the great problems associated with diets high in animal protein is deficiency of these protective factors. That may be another reason why epidemiologists consistently find an inverse correlation between the percentage of animal foods in the diet and better health. Plant protein occurs in small amounts in leaves and some tubers, and in much larger amounts in seeds. The seeds of pod-bearing plants or legumes are particularly rich sources. These include peas, beans, and lentils. All of them contain carbohydrate as well, of the low glycemic index sort, and a few, soybeans especially, contain significant amounts of fat. In addition, they are high in fiber, some vitamins like folic acid, an important member of the B complex, and protective phytochemicals. There are several disadvantages of legumes as protein sources as well. They may be toxic raw, most require long cooking to make them palatable and digestible, and many contain resistant carbohydrates that cause flatulence and other digestive problems. They may also carry residues of toxic agrochemicals. Of all the legumes, soybeans deserve most attention. Not only are they very high in protein, they have a heart-healthy oil that includes some omega-3 fatty acids. Also, as I mentioned earlier, they contain isoflavones, phytochemicals with hormonal effects that may protect both men and women from common forms of cancer. For centuries, East Asians have relied on soybeans as a staple, consuming them in a great many ways. They boil fresh green soybeans in the pod, called edamame, enjoying them hot or cold as we would eat peanuts. They make a protein-rich milk from the beans that they drink as is or turn into tofu. The skin that forms on the surface of soy milk can be dried and used as the basis for creating a variety of mock meat products. Indonesians inoculate cooked soybeans with a mold culture that binds them into mild-flavored solid cakes of tempeh, a unique food that lends itself to many different cooking methods. In both China and Japan, vegetarian cuisines that developed in Buddhist temples rely heavily on soy foods. The Chinese tradition, which also uses a lot of gluten or wheat protein, has produced an astonishing variety of facsimile foods designed to resemble in appearance, texture, and flavor classic preparations of meat, fish, and fowl. I have enjoyed this food in restaurants in Shanghai, Hong Kong, and a number of cities in the United States, where menus offer dozens of dishes, everything from Peking duck and sweet and sour pork to braised fish, all of them purely vegetarian and fashioned from soy and gluten, using all of the varied flavor principles of Chinese cooking. Western food technology has also had a good run with soy. It has isolated soy protein from other components of the beans and fashioned it into all sorts of processed foods, from powdered protein drinks to non-dairy frozen desserts and vegetarian hot dogs, pepperoni, and cheese. In fact, the amazing versatility of soy has resulted in such a profusion of products that people wishing to add soybeans to their diets may be totally confused. I think you would do well to learn about soy foods and eat more of them. Substituting them for some of the animal foods in the standard Western diet would be a healthy change, perhaps one of the healthiest changes you could make. At one stroke, you would decrease intake of saturated fat and increase omega-3s, fiber, and protective phytochemicals. You would also eat lower on the food chain and so lessen your exposure to environmental toxins, not to mention the drugs and hormones in meat. Some soy products taste terrible. If you have been turned off by them, keep experimenting, because there are now some quite delicious soy foods on the market. Be aware that highly processed soy foods, those made with isolated soy protein, may not contain the isoflavones, fiber, and healthy oil of the whole bean. Again, read labels carefully. I recommend that you also try to get products made from organically grown soybeans, since pesticides are used heavily on this crop. Many brands of soy milk on the market are good. You have a wide choice of products, from full-fat to non-fat, plain, sweetened, or flavored, and calcium-fortified. Some taste better than others. You can substitute soy milk